Welcome to Dog Talk and Kitties Too. I'm Tracy Hotchner. I'm here for everyone who loves dogs and cats, talking to experts and authors every week about the animals who share our world. Thanks for listening on Long Island's only NPR station, WLIW-FM 88.3, where Dog Talk originated 13 years ago. Listen to podcasts of the 700 previous shows in the library at RadioPetLady.com, along with Cat Chat and my other Pet Talk podcasts. Dog Talk is a production of Pet Media, Inc., which is solely responsible for its content. This show is brought to you in part with the generous support of Woruva, a family-owned pet food company that makes a vast variety of high-protein recipes for cats and dogs in cans and pouches using human-grade ingredients, which are prepared in a facility that makes food for people. This show is also made possible by Dr. Elsie's Precious Cat, a privately-owned company founded and run by Dr. Elsie, a feline-only veterinarian in Colorado who personally engineered all of his specialized litters. Dr. Elsie's is also the founding sponsor of the Cat Film Festival, which is now streaming alongside the Dog Film Festival for free on Amazon Prime and Tubi TV. My guests today are the renowned author Pamela Houston, talking about her legendary book, Sighthound, which is auto-fiction about herself and a great dog in her life. Mike Gould will be here, a founding member of the New York City Canine Unit and was there for 9/11 rescue. And Stacey LeBaron will be here from Community Cats Podcast, talking about the online conferences that are available to everyone starting soon. Well, I don't know about you guys, but I consider this a huge treat. Pam Houston's back. We're going to talk about a book of hers called Sighthound. She didn't write it yesterday, but it is absolutely a perennial, green, divine, delicious book about an incredible dog and some incredible people that hung out with him. It's a novel, but I sort of feel it's Pam and her dog. Who knows? That's how good a writer she is. We did an interview once before about her book, Waltzing the Cat. So after you hear this conversation, I recommend you go to RadioPetLady.com and go to the podcast library of Dog Talk and just put in Pam Houston, like the name of the city, and you'll find Waltzing the Cat. Her newer book, Deep Creek, won a whole bunch of awards. We're going to do that one another time. Pam, welcome to the show. Congratulations on Sighthound, which you had to order a copy for yourself because it's been so long since you had it on your shelf. Isn't it great to know that a book you wrote some years ago still has so much juice for people?
It is great. And I mean, I'm also indebted to my publisher because, unlike a lot of publishers, W.W. Norton keeps books in print for a long time. And that's something I really appreciate about them.
Well, I appreciate it too. Or then we couldn't send people to go buy it. I mean, Leash's End is a wonderful senior dog sanctuary in Virginia, and they have a reading group. And I know that they're going to just be fighting each other over Sighthound. Well, they each buy their own copy, I'm sure, but fighting each other over what part they want to talk about. Can you talk a little bit about this amazing dog that makes everybody want that kind of dog, which is ridiculous because it's a large dog with a short life, but a deep, deep spirit, right?
Yeah. This book is about Dante, which coincidentally was the name of my first Irish wolfhound and the dog that got me absolutely hooked on Irish wolfhounds. I'm still on the Irish wolfhound train all
wow.
these years later.
Nice. I'm on
Dante
it now, too. Thanks to you.
Yeah. Dante was also a teacher. You know, I think all of our dogs teach us. And I think all of our dogs come into our lives to teach us something, even the really goofy ones, you know, are there to tell us to lighten up. But Dante was like an old, old soul and probably a Buddhist, as he's portrayed in Sighthound.
Yes.
And, you know, probably a Buddhist teacher in another life. But he, you know, all of my animals throughout the years, and I've written a lot about this across my books, but, you know, they've taught me how to love unconditionally, which was not something that I learned from my parents. And they taught me how to hang in with the dying, which is another thing that Sighthound's about, you know, because it is the story of Dante's life and his death. And You know, those are not small lessons.
No. How much is it such an annoying question? How much of the character Ray is really Pam Houston? Did you have all those crazy relationships? I mean, being one of the greatest fans of your book, Cowboys Are My Weakness, you had a very lush and fascinating love life, or you couldn't have written like this. How much of Ray is you?
Oh, a lot of Ray is me. You know, it's kind of a funny thing. When I started writing Sighthounds, the reason why there's so many, there's 12 different first person narrators. There's 12 voices who come together to tell the story. And 9 of those are humans and 2 of them are canine and 1 of them is feline. And originally I didn't give Ray voice, because when I started writing the book, I was like, oh, I'm so sick of myself. Cause all of my, you know, all of my fiction and my nonfiction, of course, but even my fiction is very autobiographical. We call that auto fiction now. We didn't have that word when I was doing it back in the 90s. But yeah, it's kind of gotten its own category. But I really did. I was, you know, after Cowboys Are My Weakness and Waltzing the Cat, I was kind of sick of the sound of my own voice. I was like, let's let other people talk for a while. So I actually tried to write Sighthound without Ray's voice, with all the other voices. But then the funniest thing happened, which is that it, in a way it got even more self-obsessed, because everyone in the book was talking about Ray, you know, because she wasn't there to talk about herself. So I had found a new way to put myself at the center of the universe, and, you know, and I laughed, and then I gave Ray voice, because then other people could, you know, she could tell her own story and other people could tell theirs. But yeah, you know, Ray is heavily based on me, and this book is heavily based on an experience I had with my dog Dante. It was actually at UC Davis Vet School, where I teach, and I just, you know, when Dante was going through cancer and limb spare and all the really high tech procedures and experimental procedures he had, I spent so much time at UC Davis Veterinary. I just thought, I have to set a book in a vet school. This is a whole rich world in here. You know, I'm used to writing about outdoor spaces, but the vet school was such an amazing place and an amazing community. And that's really what the book grew out of, was my love for those people who cared for Dante.
That's really lovely, because in looking at the acknowledgments and the thank yous, which I sometimes do in a book, but not always, I did it actually before I started reading it. I don't know why, something drew me to do that. It became clear that there were some very important real life veterinarians who were in your life and in your dog's life. I'm glad now to know that it's called auto fiction. You're of course the director of the creative writing program at UC Davis, rather a big deal. So when you talk about auto fiction, or you talk about giving voice to a character, you aren't just some author spouting something. You're someone who teaches people how to do that and how to think that way. And if nothing else, the book is a blueprint for how to find incredible ways to tell a story from many different directions. But Evans, the veterinarian in the book, I was really tempted to have you read from that chapter. Instead, you're going to read a chapter where Dante is talking and then Stanley the cat is talking, because Stanley's like the greatest depiction of a cat ever. But your appreciation and love of this veterinarian and his devotion to his patients and the sleeping over with them and the, oh, wow, you really captured anyone who's a veterinarian or a vet tech or in that world should read this book as also a love letter to the greatness of veterinarians and to the depth of their commitment to their patients. And the people are kind of incidental. And that's as it should be, you know, in a really pure world. It's beautiful.
That's really what it is. I mean, Dr. Walsh was his real name, Dr. Peter Walsh, and many others too that I name in the acknowledgments, but especially Dr. Walsh. Like, he was one of those guys, and there's so many vets like this. He was one of those guys who, like, he could care less about the people.
Yes,
I mean,
yes,
you know, he was awkward. He didn't like to talk to the people. During COVID, you know, so many veterinarians, like, the people now have to sit in the car.
Yep.
And I always think of Dr. Walsh. I think this is his best way to live, because he just gets to be with the animals all the time.
He doesn't
have to deal with the human. But he was a wonderful guy, and he cared about me because I cared about Dante. And And when I was on tour with Sighthound, you know, I just can't tell you how many veterinarians came to the readings and came up to me and said, thank you. And you're absolutely right. It's a love letter to veterinarians. That's exactly what it is.
And it gives us all an appreciation, not just of the depth of the character of this individual dog, of which some of us have maybe met a dog who has some of what this dog has, maybe not all of it, because he's pretty enlightened. And he's not like a phony, fake, boring Buddha dog. He's like the real deal. He sees so deeply into the soul of his human, Ray, and all of her foibles and her weaknesses and her fears and her missteps. And he's just, it's just so lovely. I'd love to have you read part of his first chapter. The chapters are named 1, 2, 3, the number of times that that character has a chapter to themselves, and maybe set the scene a little bit, but it gets to be pretty clear pretty quickly. But set the scene a little bit as you wish.
Yeah, I think it's pretty clear. This is Dante's introduction to the reader. And he narrates a good part of the book. I don't think I need to set it up.
Agree.
I think I can just start.
Good.
A wolfhound isn't afraid to die. A wolfhound isn't afraid to suffer. A wolfhound practices non-attachment, with only modest success when it comes to the organic beef roast she cooks for dinner, and very little success when it comes to her. The tail, a very important part of a wolfhound's musculature in terms of carriage and balance, made all the more so by the amputation of one leg, reveals this failure by thwacking rather violently, as if it had a will of its own, against walls, doors, windows, every time she walks in the room. Tail to washing machine provides the best resonance, a booming, beating heart. It makes her smile 20 times a day, 200 times a week, 2,000 times a season. How many smiles hath the thwacking of one tail wrought? Countless, though more to the point counted upon and therefore forgivable, since counting upon anything has been an ability she has not heretofore possessed. She barely has the covers up in bed and I am there, rib to rib against her. She only has to think about sitting on the couch and I am there, curled up at one end, ready to warm her feet. She has hardly made a trip as far as the clothesline without me. There has never been a time when she has extended her hand into the car's back seat that I haven't licked it. I go each week to the therapist with her, and I drink the water he offers me, whether I'm thirsty or not. There are three principles to remember if you were to teach a human being anything, and they are consistency, consistency, consistency. They are such fragile creatures to begin with poor eyes, poorer hearing, and no sense of smell left to speak of. It's no wonder they're all made of fear. Some centuries ago, they moved inside, and with that move went 9/10 of their intuition. It's almost unmerciful to make them live so long when they spend their lives in so much pain. Yesterday, she and Howard and I walked in the mountains behind her ranch, which were covered with purple lupin and skyrocket helia. The little blue-gray butterflies fluttered among them, the color of barnwood at dawn. The streams are fat and full this summer. Rose was tumbling in them, scattering rainbow and golden trout, everything brimming with life and health, except me, of course, which now is of even less concern than ever before. And even I was keeping up better than usual, the crisp, dry day giving my overworked hip joints a reprieve. I heard my human singing a little song under her breath. I don't think there were words, just syllables. Doopy-doo, she sang. The grief she carries always in her face was gone. She leaned over and kissed my wet whiskers, and Howard kissed her hand. Then I stumbled a little. Nothing serious, nothing any four-legged, healthy-hearted dog couldn't have done. And when I looked at her again, she was still smiling brightly, yet behind the smile, the sadness had returned. Perhaps that's the most the humans can hope for. A moment on a blue Sunday morning when grief closes its eyes and dozes off for a while, when it relaxes its old arthritic hand. If that's true, I'll die proud of having helped her to a few of those moments. Of the day 2 years ago when I leapt the fence for her, though my heart wouldn't allow it yesterday. Of the way she gasped and clasped her hands together as my body reached the top of its trajectory, clearing the barbed wire by half a foot if it was a millimeter. And I kicked my back legs even a little higher into the air.
Wow. You know, it's like we totally get what this dog is feeling and what he's saying and how he realizes all of our frailties and weaknesses as human beings. But there's just a way you've given voice to that that makes us say, can I have a dog like that? Oh, wait, I have two dogs already. They're very much like that. But I never gave them the gratitude or the respect that you've given Dante in this book. Did you give him that level of appreciation when he was with you or when you'd lost him?
Oh, I think when he was with me, honestly. I mean, people say, like, how do you get so far into a dog's head? And I can honestly tell you, like, I feel much more able to understand what dogs are thinking than what people are thinking. Like, to me, Dante was much easier to write than, for instance, you know, the young Mormon vet tech, you know, because not Mormon, and he was a complicated dude, you know?
Yeah.
But with Dante, I mean, with my dogs, I do feel like I know most people I know think that I give them too much credit for thought and forethought and complicated emotional lives, but I don't believe I do.
I don't think
you
do.
I believe I see them.
I think
I've
you must
looking
have
looking at them all my life.
Yeah, and feeling them and feeling them feel you. Maybe you have some unfortunate people in your life that just haven't had the grace of being in that place in a dog's life, being allowed in that deeply. I think a lot of people that listen to this show understand it. I mean, I think it's really brave to go on, and you had another dog at the time, but to add dogs again and again to your life, knowing the depth of the love is obviously going to be the height of the grief and the loss. And yet this book isn't sad because this dog is such a celebration of life. Three-legged as he is, it's just really, it's such an affirmation of everything that people feel about dogs and what we imagine they feel about us. And I think you've given him the voice that he really has. I never doubted it. I mean, Howard, that's another thing. There's a whack job, but you know what? That's, you believe the character, you think, Ray, are you staying with him? Really? Okay. All right. If it works. And if Dante says it's okay, you know, Dante is sort of keeping an eye on things as strange men come and go from your life. It's darling. All right. Now the cat. I think it's great. I saw in the acknowledgments you had thanks somebody who said to you, well, can't the cat have something to say? So I thought, okay, well, is the cat going to actually speak? Let's find out. And sure enough, the cat speaks. So would you read from the chapter of Stanley, who is like the caddest cat of them all?
Yeah, I'm much more a dog person than a cat person, but this was just a student somewhere I gave a reading, and he said, aren't you going to let the cat speak for himself? And that's what gave rise to this chapter.
And it's hilarious.
There are Francophiles and there are Anglophiles. There are cooks and there are bakers. And there are dog people and there are cat people. And when anyone claims to be both, well, I have to be a bit suspicious. Ray falls squarely into the A-list in all three categories, which may explain her sloppy personal life. But Ray and I, too, have an understanding. She allows me to live in her house rent-free in exchange for keeping the mouse population in check to the point where she doesn't find little red Wrigley babies in her underwear drawer. She's not required to pet me or talk to me or make nice with me in any spurious display. But I am appreciative when she turns a blind eye to how much I enjoy sleeping on her writing chair between 10 and 12 in the a.m. when the sun hits it in a very particular way. And when she lets it slide as she finds me sucking and kneading on her blue fleece robe with the grizzly bears on it. A cat's got to exercise his instincts from time to time. After all, even a cat who has lost his balls. I'd like to go on record as saying that I like Howard, too. That I am willing to overlook all the unpleasantries involving the squirt bottle, that I now understand he was new to the house and not fully cognizant of the power structures in place, that he believed Ray when she said she was allergic, and he didn't understand, as we all have come to, that she's actually talking about an allergy of the spirit. And if I do happen to sleep on her pillow between 2:30 and 4:30, when the afternoon sun comes in their bedroom window, he now knows that it is hardly going to send her into anaphylactic shock. I'm aware that there was some confusion about the interpretation of my response to the squirt bottle. 10 little mouse heads all lined up in the mudroom, all facing the door. And I want to clarify that there was no threat intended whatsoever.
Oh, God. It's so wonderful. I mean, anyone who lives with both cats and dogs, or any of you that somehow listen to this show and you only have cats, and I admire you for doing that because you have to slog through a lot of dog talk. It's just such a great depiction of cats. They're just, it's wonderful. I mean, the book is so delightful. I know that we're going to come back, I hope, and do Deep Creek, but I just don't think anybody writes about dogs the way you do. I don't think anybody gets it. I don't think anybody gets, I guess really the thing you tap into, Pam, I think, is the sorrow of the human spirit. And you have suffered a lot personally and felt it, and then you've written it. And I think the rest of us kind of tamp it down, and we don't acknowledge how much fear and frailty and smallness we feel as humans. We just kind of buck up all the time. And what I love about your books is that when tears come to my eyes or smiles, it's as much on behalf of the humans who you humanize as the dogs who you dogify. It's really great. Mm-hmm. I mean, you do see into the human spirit, and you say what many of us are too scared to feel, but we feel it when we read your writing. I think it's really important. Mm-hmm. So thank you for that. We've run out of time, but I think you're an incredible writer. I'm obviously not the president of the fan club, but a very ardent member. And I look forward to talking to you more in the future about more of your wonderful books. Thank you for being here. This show is supported in part by Meet Me, a farm in Virginia that makes raw frozen foods and dehydrated treats for cats and dogs using their own USDA certified organic, certified humane, and non-GMO meats, all humanely raised and processed right on their own property, which is why they say ethical eats for companion carnivores from farm to bowl. This show is also brought to you by Merrick Pet Food, which began 30 years ago as a family-run company in Texas, where they're still making natural pet food. Their kibble is made without preservatives, fillers, or anything artificial. Their recipes are made under strict FDA guidelines, using only USDA-certified meats and fish, which are always the first ingredients in all their grain-free and healthy grains kibble. I am so happy to meet and welcome Mike Gould to the show. He has built an incredible franchise called Houndstown USA of grooming, doggy daycare, training, pet taxi, a huge national business with franchises all over the place. But what is amazing to me, I mean, that's already great, the American dream, build something from nothing. He was the one of the founding members of the canine unit of the New York City Police, as well as the commanding officer of the Nassau County Police Department. Mike, you have, and part of the 9/11 rescue group, your career, your immersion in dogs and what they can do with us and for us has really spanned an incredible arc, hasn't it? I mean, it's sort of from the intense to the ridiculous, if you will, or the front line to the sublime. It must be quite a wrenching change for you. Having been one of the founding members of the canine unit of the New York City Police, if I'm not wrong, when dogs were first brought into police departments, they were not brought in with open arms. Was there not a lot of skepticism?
No, that's a great point. So first, I do want to thank you for inviting me on the show and talk. It's one topic I can talk incessantly about is dogs.
Yes,
in
I
any
can tell.
Form or fashion.
Good.
But to answer your question, yeah, so the genesis of what I've done, my entire life for the most part has been what I consider in commercial, in law enforcement, and commercial applications of dogs, their uses and so forth. But to your point, yeah, so I got involved in New York City in the late 70s and early 80s. It was literally crime-ridden.
Oh,
I think we all know that crime was out of control.
Mm-hmm.
And New York City was challenged because they wanted to be a very progressive city, which they are, the progressive politics of it. But the reality was that the city itself, Times Square, what we know it now, it was nothing like that.
That's right.
Central Park, you literally couldn't walk through it.
That's right.
So the politicians answer to reducing crime in Central Park was closing the park. So then they literally closed the park, and then they said, okay, crime went down 90% with the park closed. So this concept of utilizing dogs in law enforcement is really a takeaway from the military sentry dogs during World War II, Vietnam, and so forth. So many police departments and communities was reluctant or resistant to the notion of, you know, dogs coming into their city as crime fighters. So there was a lot of pushback. But the fact is, so yes, I was one of the founding members. And so in the early 80s, New York City wanted to do a pilot program where they wanted to put a patrol dog, a canine team, into each one of the five parks in New York City, Central Park, Flushing Meadow Park, Prospect Park in Brooklyn, et cetera. So they wanted to experiment to see how the public would take to it and see how effective they were, which, right, of course, was the most important thing. And so, yeah, I was one of the founding members, which basically, what I like to say is, if you're a founding member of anything, that just means you're old. So to be a founding member, it's not comfortable for me to say. But yeah, so back in the 80s, we started this program, and I just gravitated towards it. I found it fascinating. I became obsessed with it. You know, what the dog's abilities were and what they can't do, what dogs can and can't do. And so to make a long story short, I was very effective. I was, we deployed, and I was assigned to Flushing Meadow Park in Queens and the surrounding areas. And we had a huge, huge impact on crime. It was pretty demonstrable. It wasn't questionable.
One thing I'd like to jump in and say, because people either don't know their history or have short memories, or they're too young to have a sense that there were decades before them that involved dogs in different ways. The couple of times that we've seen police canines misused recently in our current racist problem history is not how dogs were intended to be used, nor were they used. And I think it's important to understand what it was like to be afraid to walk in a park, to be afraid to walk in certain neighborhoods. It's an alien concept to people today. They waltz around. I mean, I remember when Alphabet City, which I don't think it was called that then, it's like very expensive, you know, the Lower East Side, and you couldn't go there. I went to NYU. There were junkies and murderers literally in stairwells and alleyways and on the streets. And a patrolman, there weren't enough cops to the beat cops were the ones who kept a neighborhood safe. They walked the streets. They didn't hurt anybody. They were just a presence. And having a dog with a man or a woman, there weren't probably that many police women then, gave more of a message. Like, it also kept the cops safe. The cops weren't even safe. Oh, it's hard for people to wrap their heads around that, Mike. And I think it's important to understand that it helped to make cities safe, and it didn't threaten people. It just kept bad guys at bay. How do we say that to people in the modern time? And they're like, oh, yeah, everyone, you know, heavy-handed. But dogs aren't heavy-handed now. I mean, I love to see a canine car, which they have lots on Long Island, where there's that kind of rubber mat on the window of the back so the dog can leap in and out. It's like, wow, Rin Tin Tin, right?
Yeah,
did you teach your dogs to do that, or were they in the early days, were they mostly foot soldiers?
No, that's absolutely no. We were in radio cars, and the dogs were actually literally trained to jump out the front window and when necessary. But to your point, so obviously law enforcement or any occupation, there's misuse of tools. So
correct,
a dog is a tool for law enforcement. It's an incredible tool. And it doesn't make moral decisions. So a dog is a dog. There's no difference, as you said, from Rin Tin Tin. So dogs really haven't changed domestically in over 20,000 years. So they're just incapable of making moral decisions. They don't know the mailman from a burglar.
Right.
So it's really at the hands of humans. So when we do see bad press, it's usually a misapplication of the tool that law enforcement was given. And I'm a big advocate of that. In fact, I testify, one of my other hats I wear is I'm considered an expert in this field of animals. And I testify pretty regularly. If I see a law enforcement agency misuse a dog, I'm all over it. I have no hesitation whatsoever. Sometimes it's not done intentionally. Sometimes it's just a misapplication. Frankly, the the human dog handlers don't even really understand thoroughly the dog's abilities or lack of ability in certain areas. So the public perception, dogs were an incredible psychological deterrent. Their value
That's
is
right.
more their presence
mm-hmm.
than their use. So in the 80s, when police, and maybe now, they don't have the same type of respect from the community, which I don't make a political point to that at all.
Right,
the
me
reality
either.
Is that's not right. So, but however, a dog is apolitical, right? It's a anything.
Right.
The criminal element might not care about a human police officer, but when they see a dog, it's just a psychological deterrent. So most frequently, the presence of a dog de-escalates violence
right.
because people are less likely to run or flee and so forth. So the psychological deterrent of a dog is actually probably it's one of its biggest advantages. And like a firearm or any defensive weapon, it should be very rarely used. I was a cop for 25 years, and you know, drawing a gun or shooting a gun it's rare, if not ever happens.
Right.
So it's kind of the same thing with the deployment of dogs. Their presence, their big value is their nose.
Well, that's extremely well explained, and I just think it's important to have a spokesperson on behalf of police canines to explain it, because a couple of bad apples and a whole lot of media in the modern times, or even we look back to imagery of the South during segregation and those cops who sicked their German shepherds on school children and on protesters. It's a scary image. It even goes back to the concentration camps, because German shepherds have
Absolutely.
Always been the dog of choice. So I just think it's important to understand their value and their place when properly managed in
right.
in keeping society civil and of course civil on both ends of the leash, if you will, or both sides of the leash. So we make this wild leap to how many years ago, the beginning of the 2001, you open the first Houndstown USA in Port Jefferson. And
Correct.
This was quite a unique idea at the time, to have a place where there was really cheerful doggy daycare for your dog and training and grooming and boarding and pet taxi. I mean, these were ideas that were very fresh and new. I mean, most places you took your dog to be boarded, they were sort of put in the back in a dark run. And, you know, it was unthinkable that you would, if you really loved your dog, that you would leave them there. A lot of people never went on a trip. So how did the idea spring to you of making a place so cheerful and attractive and welcoming to the people and to the dogs, a completely different hat you were wearing?
Right. So it's interesting. So I was well away on my way through my police and military career, and I was looking for something to do. And I have had this obsession or passion for understanding dogs, meaning understanding what they're capable of and what they're not. So obviously we know dogs are pack animals. They're social pack animals. So they're required by nature, not for me, but by nature, to interact with one another. So I was in my police career, I was always able to what I call group dogs together, regardless of how they look on a leash or in
right.
the back of a police car, where they look very, very aggressive and imposing. But once you give a dog, a pack animal, the opportunity and boundaries, that's what they require to do. So I had this concept of a fully interactive. I've never discriminated against a dog breed. However, we do temperament test them. I just think that. So I have a very, and I can transfer that. I can get into a dog's head, knowing what their needs are and where their brain is at in every nanosecond of time. Right. So that's really what the power of understanding the dog brain, not just putting up a fence and letting 20 dogs run together and see what happens. We've crafted a very a model that we can do these what we call temperament evaluations. But fundamentally, to your point, there's two things. There's a human perspective and then there's the animal perspective. So our customer is the dog. The humans just pay for it. So we design our facilities with the dogs in mind. We don't read them books. We don't do things that are anthropomorphic in
right.
nature, meaning we don't acquiesce to a customer. Dogs just literally want to interact with one another. They want to smell each other's genitals. They want
yes.
to run around. They want to play. That's a dog's life. That's not a human's life. So humans well, to some degree, humans want to do what they feel is right for a human child. So they do all of these, what I consider very bizarre and frankly toxic to the dog. So if you're reading books to a dog, or you're trying to make them watch television, or you're trying to teach them to sit and stay, it's a distraction. So dogs just want to interact with they, we provide this one opportunity, whether it's once a week, 5 days a week, where dogs can come and play, analogous to children, 2 or 3 year old children. You could put anywhere in the world. They don't have to speak any specific language. Give them a ball and a puddle of water.
It's true.
And
it's true.
3-year-old children are going to have a blast without human intervention. It's usually the parents or humans that kind of take the fun away from it, so to speak.
Right. And impose boundaries that aren't logical to the dogs. So here's the thing that kind of is amazing to me. So you had this idea that was novel at the time. These dogs are going to play together, and most people were all nervous and upset. And to this day, oh, but Brandy doesn't like big dogs or white dogs,
right,
or whatever.
Right.
And so you're like, right, okay, I'll check that out. And if it turns out to be true for whatever, you know, traumatic event from Brandy's puppyhood, we won't put Brandy with white dogs. But what Brandy's going to get used to some other dogs, and Brandy's going to love it. So you right, open this place, and it does huge business. And so you think, well, I'll do another one. But I'm always amazed. There are a lot of people in the services, whether it's fire or police, that go on to other professions and careers with great ambition and vision. And it surprises me, because when you're in fire or police or paramedics, you follow a lot of rules. You don't think outside the box. You don't bring your own ambition or vision to it. You do it the right way, by the book. And so here you are thinking, I'm going to get bigger and better, but keep it personal. And you go from one Houndstown, USA, to another, to then you saturate Long Island with them, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, that's kind of cool. And sure, and then you decide they should be franchises. Is that was the only way you could get bigger, but hold it to the same brand and the same ideology? How did you find
right,
franchisees? How did you pick people right, who were going to keep Houndstown the way you wanted it to be?
Now, that's a great question. So the vetting process is huge. So in franchising, we talk about not selling franchisees, but awarding them to people that we share a same culture and ideology. So that's how they're vetted. So it's not like a timeshare where we're selling Houndstowns, anybody get online. And it's not that way. We have a very comprehensive vetting process. And what I need to know, I have to be able to take a person's human brain off. The human brain is great for marketing, sales, all the things, decorating a store. But if they can't get in touch with their animal brain, which we all have a mammalian brain that lies under our neocortex, and we all have it. We don't use it anymore because our human brain has kind of suffocated that. We only use it in times of when our primal instincts need to
well
be engaged.
Well said.
So, right. So that's not easy for people. So everybody has a dog. Everybody knows a dog. Everybody has ideas about a golden retriever or a poodle.
Right.
And their favorite dog when they were young, the dog was this
right,
or that.
Mm-hmm.
So the more of this people bring to the table, I'd rather have my franchisee like dogs, but not know which end of it, which end is which the end the poop comes out and which
really?
End is the teeth end. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
Because otherwise,
frankly,
the little bit they know makes them think they know a lot.
Yes, a little bit, right? That's the saying, a little bit of knowledge can be dangerous. And,
yeah,
and this is one aspect of life that everybody knows a little something about.
That's right.
Dogs.
That's
and
right.
And dogs don't talk. So you go online, if you want to say, how do I teach a dog from not jumping? There'll be 5 different responses. How do you do this? So we just tap into we've made this so simple. And that's my problem, is humans complicate life. They complicate business.
Yeah.
They complicate everything. Their
sure,
cars. I don't even know how to adjust the seat in my car, right? I used to have a degree in computer science.
Yes, sir.
So we have a natural tendency, but dogs have not changed in thousands and thousands of years. They don't have opposing thumbs. They can't process complicated human language, and they don't stand erect. So those 3 factors, no thumbs, no not being able to stand erect, and not processing human language, is something that we take for granted. You take for granted that you can stand up. you take for granted that you can pick up a remote control, and you take it take for granted the fact that your brain can tell you which button to hit to get your favorite channel on. Dogs are never, ever, ever, ever going to have that ability. No, at least not in the next couple of 100,000 years. There's no evidence that they've evolved any much further than their ancestors, the wolf. So if we keep it simple, that is a challenge. So if you just think of humans, how we've evolved in 100 years, we now, the technology and our lives have changed. So 100 years ago, dogs would be outside in the doghouse, probably, or your grandparents, great-grandparents. Now they've worked their way into the house, and to their peril, because by allowing animals to cross these social boundaries, that's how they end up in dog rescues. Dog
well, that's a whole nother conversation for another day. We've run out of time, but I just want to say, I think what you've done with Houndstown's amazing, and putting them all over Long Island and then going to other states and making sure that it has that same point of view, I think is terrific. I think it's an incredible accomplishment, and goodness only knows what you'll come up with next, Michael, but I think you've done an amazing job so far, and I really enjoyed talking to you.
Well, I appreciate those kind words. And yeah, Houndstown is going to be a very well-recognized name in the pet care space, I think, within the next 2 or 3 years. But I thank you so much for the opportunity.
Thank you for being here. This show is also brought to you by Evermore Pet Food, which is privately owned by Hannah and Allison, two women who make freshly cooked dog food that ships directly to your home. They source organic vegetables and use only humanely raised meats, all of which would be safe for people to eat. Gently cooked, then frozen in sealed pouches, Evermore beef, turkey, or lamb dinners can be served as a complete balanced meal for your dog or as part of her diet. This show is also supported by Earth Animal, which is privately owned by Dr. Bob and Susan Goldstein, who have combined science and nature in creating many unique products for animal wellness. Dr. Bob has developed a full line of flea and tick products which use no harsh chemicals, and Earth Animal's Zen Pens deliver precisely dosed CBD gel made from full-spectrum hemp oil, which you can rub inside a dog or cat's ear to help with pain or anxiety. Stacey LeBaron is here. She created the Community Cats podcast, which has been having an online world way before the pandemic. So they have figured out that people actually can connect, come together, and do good things for cats all around the country online. Stacey, congratulations on your recent online conference, which was a huge success. You had all kinds of speakers. I mean, you've really branched out. You could, I guess, fill a convention hall if there was any such thing anymore.
Oh, Tracy, thank you so much for having me on the show. And yes, we did. We had a wonderful conference last weekend with over 300 registrations, and we talked a lot about diversity in the animal welfare space, how to do a education program for kids, a humane education program for kids. And we just had a lot of fun for the weekend. Cat trivia, just really great to get folks together and really maybe not mention the word COVID that many times.
Yeah, it would be nice if we could mention it less often. But I marvel, because when you started doing this, first of all, you had the podcast before people really had any clue exactly what podcasts were. When I started podcasting this show, after it was on the air, people would say, "What is a podcast?" And it wasn't that, it wasn't like in medieval times, not that long ago. And the same thing with online conferences. I mean, this is what you've been doing, because you're the connective tissue between many, many cat carers and cat givers and cat rescue people and people in the shelter community for a really long time. When you first started doing the online conferences, how many people came? Because, of course, we didn't even know then that people could come to an online conference. It was all very confusing. What were the numbers like in the beginning?
Yeah, so for our beginning conferences, we had probably 60 or 70 people. One of them was 38 registrations. So it was very small quite a few years ago. But, we kept at it, kept building it and growing it. And now we often will have over 500 attendees at many of our events.
It's extraordinary. It's really nice. It's extraordinary. It's also a testament not just to you having tapped into a wider community, but growing that community and figuring out what their interests are, what their needs are, and how to help them help cats. I don't know if it was an online dog saving conference, if you'd get that many people. I just think that the cat community is so just filled with passion and dedication and the desire to work together and just do what, you know, one cat at a time kind of thing. I mean, I know that you certainly like dogs, but do you ever stop and wonder if the community you've created online and in the podcast would be quite as vibrant if it were dogs?
Well, like you said, I certainly would hope so. I feel that, you know, dog owners and the folks that are in the animal welfare space advocating for dogs are as equally as passionate as sort of we are in the cat space. So I would hope so. And, you know, at our upcoming United Spay Alliance online conference, we will be talking about dogs as well as cats around the area of spay neuter.
That's really good, because while there's many more loose cats in most communities than there are loose dogs, so there's no TNR for dogs. You can't trap, neuter, and return a dog, because dogs don't live in colonies or packs the way cats do. But there's certainly a need for outreach about spay neuter in communities where there is uncontrolled breeding, as opposed to people who have complete control over their dogs, and therefore random breeding could not take place anyway. That upcoming conference is the last weekend in February. If people go to Community Cats Podcast as a website, they'll find all the topics that are being covered and a way to sign up, right?
That's correct. They just go to communitycatspodcast.com, and it's right there on the homepage. The United Spay Alliance online conference is right there. And it is. It's basically 2.5 days of talking all things spay neuter. So if you want to find out about voucher programs, how to get a spay neuter license plate in your state, how to start a clinic, how to run a mobile spay neuter clinic.
Oh my goodness.
Why is it important for public health? So there's a range of different topics. And it's just, we've really not had a spay neuter conference in probably about 5 years of the most recent spay neuter conference that I've seen posted out there on a national level. And we really just felt that it was important to bring it back. February is Feline 6x5 month. So that's a campaign promoting early age spay neuter too. So this is sort of the highlight of the month for us with our programs focused on that issue also.
That's a really good one. And Dr. Busby and the people that have been the champions of it have been on the show before. And I guess it's something that it is always important to reiterate to people, that in the same way that cats are not small dogs in their digestion or anything else, they're also not small dogs in their reproductive cycles. And, you know, do the 1 minute pitch about how at 5 months old, a cat who's a baby, who's a kitten, can get pregnant, and how many cats she can put out into the world that'll never find a home if she's not fixed by five. There's some incredible numbers. You probably know them by heart.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think the average litter size is anywhere from 4 to 6 kittens, and a cat can have, or a kitten can get pregnant as young as 4 months of age. And you can have 2 or 3 different pregnancy cycles in 1 year of having kittens just with one cat. So they do say that cats are a great multiplier. And, you know, that's what we want to focus on preventing, because we know that really the community cats that are out there, they've been survivors. They know how to survive. They usually have folks caring for them, but the kittens, they're not as street savvy and they're not as smart. And we really don't need a world with kittens outdoors. You know, 6 and 8 week old kittens are not meant to be running around, running across streets and that kind of thing. So really that's what we're about with spaying and neutering. It's really preventing those kittens from being out there in the environment and potentially being hit by cars or eaten by a predator.
So when you go to put together this conference, which in order to be 2 days has all kinds of experts in the field talking and maybe doing Q&As, do you just find out with research who the guiding lights are in the field, or who's doing really innovative and effective work, and just kind of ring them up? Of course, we don't ring up anybody anymore. But do you just contact them and say, hi, would you like to be in the conference? I mean, how do you grow this enormous family of cat caring people that you have, and these illustrious people who all join your effort gratis in order to educate more people in the world about the needs of cats. How did you make this network?
Yeah. So, well, for the conferences, I like collaborating with other organizations. And so in this case, I've collaborated with the United Spay Alliance, which is an organization that Dr. Bushby is involved with, as well as Esther Meckler. And they certainly know over the years a lot of the leaders that have been in the spay-neuter space. So we have about 24 speakers, and I would say half of them have probably come through their Rolodex, which has been a tremendous resource. And I do believe in collaborative partnerships for almost all things, and I'm thrilled to be partnered with them. And then the other 12 are folks that I will read things, I will see things out there in the world, and it is doing research. It is learning. When I'm doing the podcast, I will find out more about their programs and go, wow, you kept your high volume spay neuter clinic open all the way through COVID. That's great. That's a story. We need to share that. And so we'll have a panel of organizations who were open through everything. And what were the trials and tribulations? What were the good things, the bad things, lessons learned? So we will talk about that during the course of the weekend too. And, yeah, it's just, you know, it is through research. And, you know, Tracy, you know, I'm not a shy person either. So I have no problem reading an article about someone and just calling them up or emailing them and saying, you know, I'd like to learn more, because this is a learning process for me. I mean, I'm hoping to share information with others. But what I love so much about my job and this project is that I'm learning every day. I'm learning something new, too. And I've been in this business since 1994.
That's really what you've described is really what I do with this radio show and with Cat Chat. Yep. I mean, it's the same thing. You read an article in the New York Times or some, you know, then you have a network of people sending you links to articles in veterinary journals. And, you know, there's someone in Austria doing incredible communication work. And so you hope they speak English. And they're always, when it's a foreign land, they're, oh, my accent is a problem. And no, it's not. Your accent's great. And people are always, it's amazing that the busier the people and the more successful, the more ready they are to spread the word about the things that they're passionate about and have spent their lives studying. So it's really good that there's little mice like us burrowing around and trying to find these little stashes of brilliant, caring people. We're lucky. We're kind of the bridge, right, between these little stashes of information and disseminating the seeds, if you will, to a much bigger audience. And how great that the people that created the whole concept of Fixed by Five can come to you, or you come to them, and you have a platform where you have all the technology figured out and have for years, and have a whole bunch of people just waiting for your next conference. So it really is synergistic. They couldn't do that without you. And by having them there, you have, as you said, their Rolodex. It's so funny. It's like a record. You know, people say, oh, you sound like a broken record. You realize there's a whole generation that doesn't know what a Rolodex is or what a record is. It's like, oh my God, it's so good. We have to hold on to these old fashioned terms that actually mean something. We used to flip Rolodexes. I don't know if you ever were anybody's secretary. I was in the early years when I was in Hollywood. And your first job would be that you had to update all the addresses and telephone numbers in some executive's Rolodex. So you'd flip through this wheel of little worn out cards and have to call all these people and say, hi, I'm just updating the Rolodex. So I guess we don't have to do that anymore. What are the other conferences that are upcoming? Sort of thumbnail sketch of the ones. So that's the last weekend in February. If anybody wants to learn more about spay-neuter, and you'd just be a fly on the wall, and you don't have to be there at the time. If you're busy the last weekend in February, although how busy can anybody be these days? You can listen to it later, right, Stacey? Once you've registered, it's available to you.
All of our events are recorded. And yes, once you are registered, you'll have access to those recordings for up to a year after the conference. And so it's very easy to be able to, you know, absorb our content. You don't have to be there in person. If you want to win the cat trivia prizes, you do have to be there in person to answer the cat trivia questions. But if you want to just listen to the presentations, then you know, that's totally fine. We have an online behavior day, which is in April. So that's all things feline behavior.
Wow.
We'll have Pam Johnson Bennett there.
She's
as
great.
Well as Tabitha Crucera, Rachel Geller, and Arden Moore. So it's a sort of a four-pack day, talking about all things on feline behavior. And then in June, we have the online kitten conference. So that's a whole weekend full of kitten this, kitten that. And then in July, we have Feline Leukemia Day, which is a really passionate topic and subject to quite a few people. And we'll be talking about transport issues. Many states don't even allow you to move a cat that's feline leukemia positive from one state to another if you want to be able to adopt it out. And we're going to try and see if maybe we can change some of those rules.
Isn't that fabulous? Well, the behavior day should be interesting to even people not, you know, heavily in the trenches, because everyone has cat behavior questions. Rachel Geller has been a great partner of the Cat Film Festival when we were able to have movies in theaters. And she's been on the show a number of times, and she's great. They're all great. Pam Johnson Bennett, her books are just wonderful. Isn't that great? You've got a really wonderful crew of people. Well, Stacey, I think what you do is amazing. We just have a minute left. I wonder if there's any fabulous parting words you want to send out into the universe, because I know that you have such positive energy, and we all need a shot of that positive energy while we're waiting for the other kind of shots that we need to get.
Yeah, well, I want to thank everybody for tuning in. And, you know, even if you are a dog lover, passionate about dogs, you know, my theme is always turn your passion for cats into action. But if you have a passion for dogs, please turn that into action also and help the dogs in your community do what you can. And don't be shy. You know, there's a lot that can be done, little or big. You can do it. You can make a difference in the lives for animals in your own community.
And then you make a connection to other people in the community that are doing this. And if anything, we were all too, I think, distanced from each other even before we were forced to be. So I think that these communities that you put together, Stacey, bring people together, person to person, as well as person to cat. I salute you for that. I think the work you're doing is amazing, and I'm hoping lots of people sign up for the great conferences you have coming up. Thank you for being here and for all the good you do in the world.
Thank you, Tracy.
Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed the guests as much as I did. Kiss your kitties and hug your pooches, and we will talk again next week. Bye for now.